My friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is December 18, 1976, and this is my monthly audio letter number 19. As our bicentennial year of 1976 draws to a close, the United States of America is in grave danger. Our economy is ravished by the twin plagues of high inflation and high unemployment, a condition which I named stagflation some years ago. Our republic is under attack and a far advanced plan to bring our country under dictatorship. Our very lives are under the threat of extinction in a surprise nuclear attack, which would be the beginning of Nuclear War I. And all of these terrible things have been brought about deliberately by a handful of ruthless, powerful men, here and abroad, bent on world domination. But how can this be, you ask? How can so few people control the destinies of all the rest of us? After all, it is easy to imagine how far our secret rulers and their henchmen would get if they try to take over even one city, much less all of America, with their own bare fists and brute force. They would be stopped in their tracks in no time flat, because everyone understands that kind of threat, and there are far more of us than there are of them. But those who want to enslave us understand this all too well. They know better than to try any kind of frontal attack on us that would be widely understood. Instead, they have perfected the art of harnessing our own energies so that gradually, step by step, we are enslaving ourselves under their control. The Hegelian principle of thesis, antithesis, synthesis is being applied so as to gradually merge our life with that of the Soviet Union at every level. The average working man and woman in America would never knowingly allow this to happen, and yet it is happening, gradually, year after year. The first step, called thesis, is to create and publicize a problem in education, economics, or otherwise in our daily lives. In other words, where there is peace, create discord and trouble. Step two, antithesis, is to create opposition to the problem. The final step, synthesis, is to offer a so-called solution to the problem. This diabolical, roundabout approach psychologically conditions people to accept things which they would otherwise oppose vigorously. Just a look around with this in mind, and you'll see that this technique is being used all around you in a thousand ways. But the real key to the success or failure of this method of manipulating the public lies in something Abraham Lincoln said over 100 years ago. Quote, "With public sentiment, nothing will fail. Without it, nothing can succeed." Unquote. So long as we, the people, are simply told the truth about things, public sentiment reflects the truth. Under those conditions, real solutions can be found for real problems to everyone's benefit. But when we are not told the truth, public sentiment reflects only what we believe, and we can be manipulated into supporting all kinds of things that are not in our best interest. Here in the United States, a subtle long-range propaganda technique, known simply as misinformation, has been used to build up an artificial and false picture of the world and our own nation. In the areas of foreign policy, national security, politics, and economics, the truth has been suppressed and replaced with an elaborate structure of lies, distortions, and half-truths. This false picture has come to be accepted as the truth, with the result that the truth itself has been rendered unbelievable. I don't think anyone in his right mind could do what has been done to us. Our education, our constitution, our free enterprise system, everything possible has been perverted in order to confer ever more power on our secret rulers. Now, war is coming. The wars of this century have been fought far from our shores, but this time it is coming here, to our land, to our homes, to our people. It will not be a conventional war, but nuclear war one. As in all modern wars, it will begin with a surprise attack. Thanks to the silence of the United States government and of the controlled major media, most Americans will be caught completely by surprise, believing in a lie called detente, until thermonuclear fireballs erupt all around our nation. To show how different the truth is from what we are led to believe by our secret rulers, I will discuss these three topics today. Topic number one, why the United States was not first to launch an Earth satellite. Topic number two, why most Americans cannot believe nuclear war is imminent. And topic number three, how the major tax-exempt foundations have cleared the way for Soviet nuclear attack. Topic number one. On the evening of October 4, 1957, Americans were stunned by the announcement that the Soviet Union had become the first nation in history to place a man-made satellite in orbit. Sputnik 1, weighing 184 pounds, was circling the Earth every hour and a half, sending out beeps that became famous overnight. The world was thrilled, and the world press heaped great praise on the Soviet Union. They inferred from this accomplishment that the Soviet socialist system was superior to our own in scientific and technical progress. It was an historical first that can never be undone. The Soviet Union had beaten the United States into space. Less than a month later, Sputnik 2 was launched. It weighed over a half a ton and carried the first live passenger into space, a dog. The dog died within a week, but it was another startling achievement nonetheless. Meanwhile, poor old America was struggling along, trying to put a tiny 16-pound satellite into orbit by means of the Navy's Vanguard rocket. Two launches were attempted, but both failed. In one case, the rocket lifted a few feet off the pad, only to settle back into a tremendous fireball as it exploded. It made exciting footage for the television news that evening. Finally, on January 31, 1958, almost 4 months after Sputnik 1, America launched its first space satellite from Cape Canaveral, Florida. It was called Explorer 1, and it was launched not by the Navy, but by the Army. We were in space at last, but only after being thoroughly humiliated before the entire world. After the Sputnik shock, space flight and rockets were suddenly the end thing to be interested in. Even then, Senator Lyndon B. Johnson arranged for a new Aeronautics and Space Committee to be set up, with himself as its chairman. He was thereafter as visible as possible in connection with space matters. And today, the Manned Space Flight Center in Houston bears his name. At the time, I could hardly imagine anything more hypocritical for Johnson to do. Even though I was a lawyer, I had been a member of the then-named American Rocket Society for a number of years and had vivid memories of Johnson's attitude toward space in the early 50s. At that time, 4 or 5 years before Sputnik, I was a member of a group headed by Dr. Wernher von Braun, who approached Johnson in hopes of obtaining support for a space program. I'll never forget Lyndon Johnson's reaction to the whole idea. He did not merely say no, but jeered at the whole concept as ridiculous and worthless. A few years later, the United States was deprived of the chance to be first in space, but not by Lyndon Johnson. What I am going to tell you does not affect our national security now, but it does provide a typical example of what has been happening to America for many years. And as Wernher von Braun lies on his deathbed in a hospital near Washington, D.C., I believe the time has come for the truth to be told about why we were not the first to put a satellite into space. In late 1955 or early 1956, the Joint Chiefs of Staff began the first active planning for an American space program. Their goal? To have the United States initiate the world's first successful space flight at the beginning of the International Geophysical Year that was to begin on July 1, 1957. After some controversy as to which service should sponsor the space project, it was concluded that the Army was most capable of doing the job. This was agreed to and approved by the Joint Chiefs and by then Secretary of Defense Charles Wilson. The Army's Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama, was fortunate in having the services of the world's foremost rocket expert, Dr. Wernher von Braun. From a very early age, von Braun had been fascinated with the idea of space flight, and he had spent his life working with rockets. During World War II, von Braun was pressed into service by Hitler, and the German rocket program was far ahead of other countries by the end of the war. When the war ended, many of von Braun's subordinates at the German rocket base were taken prisoner by the Soviet Union, and it was they who were forced to develop and direct the Soviet missile and space programs. But von Braun himself had resolved well before hostilities ended that he would surrender to the United States, and he succeeded in doing so. Our government then prevailed upon him to enter governmental research, where he would have the money and resources to pursue rocketry in earnest. When the Earth Satellite Project came under consideration years later in the mid-50s, the Joint Staff Project officers interviewed the Redstone Arsenal officials, along with von Braun himself, to ascertain their capability. Von Braun stated that his group could engineer a space vehicle and have it ready for orbit in only a few months. The Joint Staff pushed for the von Braun project, and after it was approved by the Joint Chiefs and Secretary of Defense, it went to President Eisenhower for a final approval and allocation of Defense Department funds. But there it stopped. Strangely, there was a long delay in getting the expected presidential approval. Finally, the word came down to the Joint Staff from the President. Incredibly, they were to disregard the Army's capability and give the space project to the Navy instead. Such a decision was all but unbelievable. The Navy did not even have a blueprint for such a space vehicle. They would be starting almost from scratch. But the decision stood, so several large aircraft companies and Navy scientists gathered to initiate a program called Project Vanguard. As a direct result of this decision, the Soviet Union was able to put Sputnik into orbit while the United States was still struggling unsuccessfully with Vanguard. Joint Staff Project officers were most perplexed about the American political decision to allow the Soviet Union to beat us in this endeavor when we had the capability to be far ahead of them. It appeared to follow a pattern of withholding American capabilities and allowing the Soviet Union the advantage. Later, an aide to President Eisenhower explained confidentially what had transpired. A select group of scientists and financial leaders got wind of the American space satellite plans at an early stage. The group, headed by a man who was later awarded the Lenin Peace Prize by the Soviet Union, went to the president and pressed him to sponsor a purely American space project with only Native Americans working on it. They didn't want by any means for a former German such as Wernher von Braun to give the world and future historians the impression that the Germans of all people were superior in the field of space science. This group, who were actually doing the bidding of the Rockefellers on behalf of their Soviet allies, were instrumental in forcing America to take a back seat in the early years of the space age, when we were fully capable of being supreme. Finally, after two Soviet Sputniks and two humiliating Navy Vanguard failures, Eisenhower became exasperated and told the Defense Department to get von Braun into action. Just 6 weeks after he received the go-ahead, von Braun's army team launched Explorer 1. He did exactly what he had said he could do 2 years earlier, and the very first time he tried it. But the special place in history he so richly deserved had been denied him forever, just as it had been denied to the new homeland of his choice, the United States of America. The anti-German argument that had been used on President Eisenhower was, of course, a total fraud. When Sputnik 1 was launched, a short dozen years after World War II, the Soviet rocket program was even more dependent on the efforts of captured German scientists than was true in the United States. Thus, only one thing was really accomplished by delaying the Army satellite effort under Wernher von Braun, a tremendous propaganda coup for the Soviet Union and a setback to American prestige and self-confidence that persisted for years. It is a grim fact that accolades go to the spoilers and traitors among us, but no acclaim to our true heroes and men dedicated to American principles. Under the enthusiastic leadership of Wernher von Braun, the United States was able to come from behind to win the race to the moon. But soon, the world press will have relegated him to the footnotes of modern history. Like General Douglas MacArthur, Wernher von Braun will just fade away. Topic number 2. When Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger was fired by President Ford just over a year ago in November 1975, he said, quote, "Some years from now, someone will say, why weren't we warned? And I wanted to be able to say, indeed you were," unquote. But most Americans, when reminded of this parting statement by Schlesinger, tend to be surprised. It is as if his words had gone out into thin air, leaving no lasting impression at all. This is a perfect illustration of the way in which the American public had been left comfortably asleep by the controlled major media of our country, oblivious to the steadily mounting threat of war. Around the world, the alarms of impending nuclear disaster are jangling louder and louder. But these alarms are muted, muffled, and silenced by the time they reach you. When isolated facts about American or Soviet military developments are reported, it is done in such a way that it has little lasting impact on most people. Thus, for example, you may hear a news item concerning the debate over the new B-1 bomber, which the United States Air Force is developing. Taken in isolation, you may well wonder what all the shouting is about, and for that matter, why such a new bomber is even being considered in this age of missiles. Or you may hear a brief news item mentioning that the Air Force wants to buy some F-15 fighters to augment our air defense system. Perhaps these things would make a little more sense to you if you knew that the Soviet backfire bomber began to be deployed operationally over 3 years ago. The backfire is a supersonic, long-range bomber capable of delivering nuclear weapons to targets here in the United States, And that, my friends, is precisely its purpose, not the so-called peripheral missions mentioned by some. Knowing this, perhaps it would have struck you as a little strange that in 1974, after the Soviet backfire bomber began being deployed, the United States virtually dismantled its air defense system. At the very time that a renewed Soviet bomber threat was developing, our network of interceptors was reduced to just 6 active Air Force squadrons, plus 6 more in the Air National Guard. The extensive network of Nike Hercules anti-aircraft missiles under Army command was shut down completely. But now, with war threatening to break out, the Defense Department is reversing its position on air defense without telling you why. The mounting controversy over the relative military strength of the Soviet Union and the United States has taken many people by surprise. Almost 3.5 years ago, the warning was sounded that the Soviet Navy had become stronger than the United States Navy. That's what the world's foremost naval authority, James Fighting Ships, said in July 1973. But if you saw this reported at all by the major media, did it make any impression? Or consider the matter of long-range ballistic missiles. Over 4 years ago, on November 27, 1972, the Soviet Union successfully test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile with a range of 4,500 miles. By comparison, the most advanced American sub-launched missiles have a range of less than 3,000 miles. In addition, the development of a whole new series of Soviet missiles was underway. Early this month, the Soviet Union began a 20-day period of tests of the new submarine-launched SSNX-18 ballistic missile, firing them into circular zone 100 miles in radius in the North Pacific, southeast of the Aleutian Islands. The SSNX-18 now has a multiple warhead capability, and these tests, which are full operational tests, extend over the full range of the missile, which is now more than 5,000 miles. Particular attention is being given to warhead performance in these test-proving flights. If all goes as planned, the SSNX-18 will be committed to full production and operational status within a year's time. The SSNX-18 will give the Soviet Union a commanding lead over the United States in the realm of submarine-launched ballistic missiles. But what have you learned from network news reports or other major media about this missile? Practically nothing. But the most tortured reasoning I have seen yet appeared on December 6, 1976 in the New York Times. An editorial on that date entitled Moscow's Submarine MIRV begins with the incredible words, and I quote, "The Soviet Union's first successful test of a submarine-launched ballistic missile armed with MIRV multiple nuclear warheads is good news, paradoxically, for the United States and the world," unquote. The editorial then argues, in effect, that since this will eliminate the one remaining missile advantage held by the United States, it opens the door for the Soviet Union to make concessions and salt negotiations that could prevent either side from acquiring a first strike capability. Such Alice in Wonderland reasoning may still serve the purpose of lulling millions of Americans back to sleep, but it would not sit well these days with most NATO defense ministers. For the first time, many officials in NATO are genuinely alarmed by the continuing, relentless buildup of Soviet power in Europe, where the best Soviet troops are concentrated. For example, consider Denmark, which sits astride the channels which lead from the Baltic Sea to the North Sea. Soviet activity in the Baltic has grown more and more ominous of late. Early in September, a Soviet task force suddenly materialized off the southeast coast of Denmark, then left then reappeared. All kinds of Soviet naval war games are now being carried out practically on Denmark's doorsteps. So close that they could suddenly turn into an attack that would give practically no warning. Danish Foreign Minister K.B. Anderson said recently, "I'm astonished at what is going on. This is completely contrary to the expectations created by the Helsinki Agreement," unquote. And yet, our kept press would have you believe that the new Soviet SSNX-18 missile I just told you about is unimportant or even good news because of possible agreements the Soviet Union might make about it. At the NATO defense ministers' meeting in Brussels earlier this month, Admiral Sir Peter Hill Norton of Britain warned that the trend of the military balance between East and West is continuing to move in favor of the Soviet bloc. He declared that more money and better planning are needed if NATO is to match what he called the relentless determination of the Warsaw Pact countries to achieve military superiority. He warned that NATO can no longer rely indefinitely upon the superiority of Western technology because massive Soviet spending on research and development have resulted in vast improvements in Soviet weapons. As Dutch Defense Minister Verdeling said on December 8th, the day after Sir Peter's speech, quote, "The situation as far as the balance of forces worldwide is more serious than many people think," unquote. And there are many other examples of genuine alarm at the vulnerability of Western Europe to a devastating surprise attack. What did Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who was and is a CIA operative, have to say to the NATO ministers? He gave a brief nod to the widespread concern over the Soviet buildup. But what you heard reported in the news emphasized the following, and I quote, "I think the alliance is healthy. I leave my post as Secretary of Defense next month with a good deal of optimism about the Atlantic Alliance. The fact that it survived some 26 years, the fact that it's working, I think, reasonably smoothly at the present time, frankly reassured by the fact that there is an Atlantic Alliance, that it's on watch and doing its job," unquote. And so, my friends, we can all go back to sleep comfortably reassured.